come in. This is a strange talk for me to give, actually, because it's not to talk about the research that I do. It's a talk about how I do research. So it's a subtle difference there. And I'm used to giving presentations where there's lots of pretty pictures from the different visualizations that that I give. This particular talk has hardly any pictures in it. That's one or two. And it's mostly text, which usually I hate having talks which are just text. So to compensate for that, I'm hoping that it'll be slightly more interactive as well. And what I'm going to talk about, as it says in the title, is how to be an effective researcher. So I'm not just talking about funding, I'm talking about other things as well. And I don't want to claim that I'm anything special here. I'm certainly not any Nobel laureate or anything like that. But I do think I have been effective at doing research over the last 20 years or so. And I'm just going to tell you how I went about it from when I started my research career, the sorts of activities I threw myself into and I'm still involved in, which I think helped me along the way to be effective. And I'm sure you all have different experiences, and I'm quite happy if you interrupt me and give me an example from your own careers and your own research activities that's worked well for you as well. So please do that, and don't just sit there listening to me going on and on and on for 30 to 40 minutes. So that's setting the scene. So I've got to use my big virtual blackboard here to write what a few pointers and other things to stimulate your discussion, I hope. So I've got to talk a little bit about my background, just so you know where I've come from, how I've got to Chester today. And then to be an effective researcher, I sort of divided it into three or four different sections. I'm going to talk a bit about getting new publications out, you know, being part of a research team. Building esteem as well, I think, is an important thing that we need to do as researchers. And all those things help along the line to actually getting funding, which is what we want to be successful, really. And then I'll open it up at the end to more discussion if you haven't interrupted me as I'm going along. So I'll just give you a very potted history of what I've done in terms of research. And I'll reference my website here, which I've embedded on the page here. So if you can check that website out if you like, nigeljohn.org, which I've written it as a sort of a blog of my research experiences way back from when I did my PhD. And here's a little picture from a 3D computer animation that was produced during my PhD. And I don't really like pointing out the year that I did this. It's 1986 to 1989 is when I was doing my PhD at the University of Bath. And I was always interested in computer graphics, and my PhD was to do with 3D computer animation. In the days before you could go and buy 3D Studio Max or any sort of package like that, they didn't exist. I had to write my own 3D computer animation package. So that was my introduction to research, but when I finished that, I was feeling a bit strapped for cash, really. It's not the most profitable activity doing a PhD degree. So I didn't look to stay in academia. I thought it would be a good idea to go and get an industrial job. And I went around the milk round, and I ended up accepting an offer from ICI on their graduate recruitment scheme. And I moved from Bath to Chester, in fact, and started working for ICI in Runcorn. And during my time there, ICI decided that they were going to split the company into two, and the pharmaceuticals part of the business became called Zeneca, and I ended up with them. And when I was with Zeneca, and there's a project here called 3D Ultrasound, that was at Zeneca. Zeneca had a lot of medical imaging equipment. They had MRI scanner, they used a lot of ultrasound. And I got involved in a project to try and create 3D data sets from a 2D ultrasound scanner. And that was the first time that anybody had tried to create 3D ultrasound. And that got me really back into thinking that research is quite good, really. And I was lucky to be able to do some research while working for a company who paid me reasonably well. And after a few years, I think I spent 5 years altogether at ICI and Zeneca. I then moved to another company called Silicon Graphics, who at the time were the biggest company in the world for computer graphics, US, California-based company, but they had offices all around the world. I was based in the Manchester office, and I was helping the sales guys, I guess, to sell the hardware. But I also made it my specialism while I was there to develop my interest in this medical imaging world. And one project I was involved with, which is this project here, was to do volume rendering of medical data within a web browser. The web browser we used in the late 90s was usually Netscape. So this is a picture of Netscape with a volume rendering in it. So I had about 8 years altogether in industry before I decided that really it's the research that I like doing. Problem with working for somebody like Silicon Graphics, you had to do a lot of traveling. There was a lot of sort of sales activities involved with it, which I wasn't so interested in. I liked the research projects. And an opportunity came up at Manchester University in the Manchester Visualization Centre. And they wanted somebody to run that group. And I thought, well, I'll throw my CV into the hat to see if they're interested in me. And they were. And I took the decision to leave this industrial world behind, take a salary cut, and I went back into a university role. But I certainly don't regret that. No, it's been a great time since, when did I go to Manchester? I think it was 98, and I've been in academia ever since. 12 years at Bangor University, and now last year I came to Chester University. So that's where my research activities really started, was when I went back into the university environment at the Manchester Visualization Centre. So I've worked for lots of different organisations in my career. Luckily, I've lived in Chester the whole time as well, so my family life has been good, and I've worked for big industry, three different universities, and always managed to live almost in the same street in Chester during that time. So that's been good for me. But what I've certainly found is working for different organisations has helped me. Not only has it expanded my network, the people I know, the people who I've gone back to over the years to collaborate with, it really, by working at different locations, you know, that has given me all sorts of different experience, opportunity to learn about different environments, how different people do things. So that's part of the experience that I think helps me be an effective researcher, this variety of roles that I've had over the last 20-odd years.
Question.
Seven.
You said that it's okay if we interrupt you.
Yeah.
It's okay to work for different organizations, or it's important to look for to work in different projects, completely different as style?
I mean, it could be a bit of both, I think. And it sort of depends on what your individual research strategy is, really. Where do you need to go to get the experience that you need? And it may be that different projects in the same organization will give you that. I really think that if I look at the really successful people in UK academia and beyond, very few of them would have been at the same university for their entire career, though. Maybe some in Oxford and Cambridge, perhaps. But you look elsewhere, people move around. And I think you need to be prepared to move around in order to become more effective. You could probably get by staying in the same place, doing the same sort of thing, but you're limiting your opportunities, I think, by doing that. So I'm not telling everybody they should now start looking for another job away from Chester. But, but in your long-term career path, you should bear that in mind. Yeah. And do I think my industrial experience helped? Well, it did, particularly in the early years of my transition from industry back into academia. The contacts I had in industry helped me a lot. And we'll see later how some of my European projects that I got involved with used the companies that I was trying to sell Silicon Graphics kit to, for example. Probably the benefit has waned over time, because it's a long time now since I worked for Silicon Graphics. And it's always a bit of a trade-off as well. If you're working for a company, they like patents. They don't like so much you publishing paper into your journals or going to conferences. They want to patent everything in case they can make money out of it. So there's always that trade-off about how you publish the research that you're involved with, and can you do it easily? But also, being in an industry, I think, does give you more impact to the research that you're doing, because they want to exploit that research, make money out of it. And the way things are in the academic world, the impact of our research is more and more important. So having links with industry can help perhaps get more impact from our research. And also to start developing my network. And all of us have our own networks, the people we know, the people we've met at conferences, at different universities, different companies. You need to cultivate that network. You never know when the person you meet is going to be useful to you further down the line. And you need to put some effort into that. And just checking with people you might not have seen for a while, how are they doing? Because you never know when you want to start collaborating with them. So go and visit your colleagues. If you get invited to give talks elsewhere, do it. You know, don't turn them down. You can even get funding to help you do this type of networking. And I want to sort of just raise your awareness of one particular funding body, which I benefited from, and I think are fantastic. And it's the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. You have to be a UK citizen to apply to them. But what they do is fund people to go on networking trips, really, overseas. And between 4 to 8 weeks, they will fund you to do pretty much wherever you like. You have to write a proposal, and they have different themed categories in which proposals fit. And they do this annually. And I think last year they handed out about 150 scholarships to be a Churchill Travelling Fellow. And in 2013, I was lucky enough to be one of those people. And I funded a networking trip to Singapore and Australia. And I spent some time with CSIRO, the big government research outfit in Australia, during that 2013. It was also the summer that the British Lions were touring Australia, but that was purely coincidental. And the fact that I went to some test matches got nothing to do with it. But the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust, I didn't know anything about them. But I knew that I wanted to spend some time in Australia because part of my network. In fact, one of my old PhD students had relocated to Australia, and he's working for CSIRO, and he wanted me to come over. So I just started looking for ways which I could fund that trip. So I just used Google, tried to find the information about scholarships for funding sabbaticals and overseas trips, and I came across the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. I spent about 2 days writing an application for them, and they ended up giving me a cheque for about £5,000. They didn't want any receipts. They just said, we think your trip will cost you this much. Off you go. Any money left over, we'd want to know about that. And I just went off to Australia and had a fantastic time working with different labs and in Singapore. So look out for them, and you should try and apply to them. I think they issue their calls around about October time, and then they have interviews just after Christmas, and then the fellowships normally start around about June time. So the next cycle will be coming towards the end of this year.
So excuse me, you get to travel to any country you want to?
Yes, you have to put together your portfolio of what you want to do and why you want to do it. Okay. And so you have to have a good argument, and what their remit is that when you come back to the UK, you will have learned something that will be a benefit to the UK itself. Okay. And so that's the way you have to pitch it. If anybody wants to investigate that, I'd be happy to talk to you more about it, show you my application and how I went about it. I guess another important message is that you need to be passionate about your research as well. You've got to enjoy what you do, or you'll never be effective. Now, it does take time for you to discover what your true passion is, and I've worked on different areas of computer science and visualization over the years. But it was always the medical applications of computer graphics and visualization that really interested me. And that's where my passion is. So for a long time, it's been clear to me what I like doing and where I put my efforts and enthusiasm to try and get funding and be known in that area. So each of you will have your own passion. And if you're quite new, still doing PhDs, you may find that your future research will be quite different from what you're doing for your PhD right now. But it will evolve, and you will know what it is you want to do as you get more experience. So an important part of the jigsaw is your publications. if you're going to be an effective researcher, you have to be very active at publishing. And this would go back to when you first did your PhD. Now, most of the people in this room have been doing a PhD or currently doing a PhD. And that's probably where you had your first experience of publishing a paper. And I think part of the experience of doing PhD research is hopefully to instill you with that discipline, that whatever experiments you've been doing, you need to write them up and submit them to a conference or journal. And that's a very good discipline to get into early on in your research career. There's a lot of wasted work, I think, which people have done and have just got lazy about writing it up. And some of my former PhD students are very much in this category. I've really had to push them to write up their work. And once you start to get your publication list noticed, start to get citations, that's all going to help you further down the line. And of course, REF is our current taskmaster, as I say there. And every university will want to be returning its departments to REF to show the quality of the research that's going on within that department. And for the last REF, the way they measured the quality of your outputs was using this star basis from 1-star to 4-star. It's a bit subjective, and they'll have a panel of people who actually judge the work to see whether it is 4-star or whatever. And what we want is for our papers to be at that 4-star level or at least 3-star. The way the funding model works for each university, you know, every department gets their REF profile, and then there's some QR money that goes to universities, but it's only the 3-star and 4-star research that counted last time. Anything you returned that was 2-star. This is not how the REF panel word 1-star, but that's how I word it. You're not going to get any funding for research at that level. You need to be up at this top level. And here at Thornton and in our faculty, we will be developing our REF return for 2020, is it, or the next one. And for many of the departments here, it'll be the first time that they're returning to REF. And that will be an important target for us over the next few years, is to get outputs, publications, which are going to be 3-star and 4-star.
So, could you just say a bit more about how that funding actually finds its way to the university? How does a certain number of 4-star or 3-star papers affect the funding?
The important thing is the GPA, the grade point average that the university has as a result of all the units that it's returned. And there's a formula that Hefke will have, given that the GPA for the university, they've got a pot of money that they can give for research activity, and it's that GPA score which is used in the formula for how much each university gets. And the Oxbridges and the Imperials are going to be high up there getting lots of research money. Chesters at the moment, so they're not going to get too much from the research funding. And it's not a linear scale. I think it's very much that most of the money goes to the Russell Group universities that are really research active, and it's less and less money available as you go further down the ranking tables. But that's about right, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a non-linear allocation model. I think this university got about £1 million in QR funding, from the last round, compared to what Manchester would have got 58, and they would do very well, and Imperial would get something like 90. Maybe.
Yeah, so it's a huge, huge difference, which is why they have so much resource to continue doing well, whereas the universities further down the list have to work a lot harder to.
Does the REF affect funding from EPSRC or Innovate UK?
It does, maybe not directly, but when your grant application is being looked at, there's no doubt that the reviewers will be considering where you're coming from as part of their evaluation. Even if they're not supposed to do that, they will. And if you're not coming from what's seen as a research-active university, then your proposal, I'm afraid, has to be even better than perhaps your colleague at that research-active university in order to get funded. I'll say a little bit more about how the EPSRC works a little later. I've got some more coming up on that.
Nigel, what exactly is REF? I'm not a PhD student, so I don't know.
So REF was introduced, I think, in 2001 was the first exercise. And it's the government wanted to have some way of measuring the quality of research that UK universities carry out. And it's evolved a little bit over time, but what it boils down to is that all the research active staff in the university are looked at, and what outputs are they producing, such as publications. But it's not just that, it's also how much grant income are the staff capturing, what sort of esteem they have in the community, and for the last REF, a new part of it, which is going to grow, is something they call impact. So you have to show how some of the research that's done at your university has had impact to the wider community. So that could be industrial impact, but it could be other things as well. And these are weighted slightly differently. The output is weighted the most. It was 40% of the quality profile took account of your outputs. And each member of staff who got returned had to select their four best outputs, which were ideally it would be four 4-star papers, but few people have four 4-star papers.
So it's basically for PhD students only?
No, it's not for PhD students at all, really. It's more for the academics in post. PhD students are another equation in the overall profile is how many PhD students have successfully graduated during the REF period. But a PhD student doesn't have to worry too much about the REF returns, but your supervisor certainly will be. So the paper, if you're a PhD student and you're producing good papers that your supervisor is named on, then he'd be able to use those as part of his REF or her REF return.
And it's worth just mentioning that there's something called an early career researcher, which gives you remission from the four outputs. So if you've only been in post as a new academic for perhaps 2 years out of a 5-year cycle, you don't have to produce four outputs. You might only have to produce one or two to be included within the system. And your outputs are all peer-reviewed. Yep. So there's a panel of the great and the good who supposedly read every single paper, every single academic that's been submitted to the REF, and then rate it on those categories, 1 to 4.
Yeah, and the panels, there's several panels focused on the different disciplines. So there's one for computer science, and a different one for mathematics, different ones for engineering.
Nigel, you mentioned about IEEE and ACM being better than, say, other journals and conferences.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, yeah.
Okay, there's a rating somewhere.
It depends on your particular field, and it will vary. But for me, I know that if I publish in an IEEE transactions journal or an ACM journal, that they are very rigorous in their reviewing and they only accept best. So for me, that's a benchmark. IEEE transactions, that's at least a 3-star as a rule of thumb. But if I go for some online journal that was never heard of and they suddenly email me an invitation to submit a paper, it's probably not worth the effort of doing it, because they'll be so far down the quality of the journals that it wouldn't be rated as about 1 or 2-star.
But the rating of the actual paper you publish doesn't have to be related to the journal you publish it in.
No,
the 4-star.
So so you could have a really good paper in perhaps a lesser journal, but you get cited so much that it becomes the paper that everybody signs in, and that's fine. And the citation count is looked at. They were saying last time that they weren't going to look at the citations, but then they were, and so you're never quite sure what the panel do. And in computer science, they were going to start using Google Scholar rather than World of Science. You can be sure that if you've got a well-cited paper, that's going to be a good paper to give us your outputs. So when you are trying to publish, be ambitious. Go for those top journals in your field. So for me, I like to try and submit to IEEE or ACM. And maybe the paper won't be accepted. But the reviewing process is so good at those papers that the comments that you get back are often really, really useful. And you can use the comments, even from rejected papers, to make significant improvements to that paper. And you can try elsewhere. And often you get depressed because some of the comments that you get are quite negative at times. And the first time, imagine if you were doing your PhD and your first paper comes back and you've got this incredibly critical comment, you feel really depressed and think, oh, what am I doing this for? I'm obviously useless. But you shouldn't. Everybody gets negative comments. And some referees go out of their way, I think, to give negative comments. They see it as some sort of sport, I think. But but even so, if you need to dig through those comments and see what points are being made which are good points and use those good points to improve that paper and then try again. Don't give up on that paper.
Sorry, Nigel, how do IEEE conferences count?
They wouldn't be as good as an IEEE journal. And a conference is probably... There are some really good conferences will publish their proceedings in a journal anyway. So for me, the best conference in the computer graphics world is a conference called SIGGRAPH, and they actually publish their proceedings in the ACM Transactions on Graphics. So that is 4-star if you get a paper there. The thing with the IEEE is they like to put their name on a lot of conferences because it's a money earner for them as well. And the conference pay the IEEE for the right to use the IEEE branding and publish in the IEEE library. And they're not really anything to do with the IEEE other than they're using them as their publisher. At those conferences, your paper's in there, 1 or 2-star. You need that journal paper, really, to make sure that they're at the high level of quality. Yeah.
So basically, what one should do is focus on the impact factor of each journal, and then try to aim on higher.
Oh, well, that can be tricky as well because impact factors between disciplines vary a lot, and certainly computer science, where you tend to be collaborating with many other disciplines, you might find that. For me, I'm very collaborating with a medical guy, and some of the medical journals have incredibly large impact factors. 20, 30 is up there, whereas the top journals focusing on just computer graphics are about 1 or 2 in impact factor, but they will still be the top ones to go for in my field. So you have to be a little bit careful on looking at impact factors alone and look at a sort of a wider picture. But in general, good journal is better than a conference, but it's not the whole story. And you need to be organised, okay? As academics, research is just one part of our role. We have, of course, big teaching responsibility, and there's different administrative duties you have to do as well. But you need to set some time aside for your research activities and make sure you take that time as well. Do you have a research plan? What is it you want to achieve? Sit down and think about that. You've got the particular area that you're interested in, but what is it you want to do in that area? What are your sort of 3-year plan or 5-year plan? You should have that written down, and it's good discipline to do that. Have your to-do lists. And then when you start doing research, it's very easy to get sidetracked. You start off on one idea, then you think about something else, and you go, let's investigate that, and you forget about that first idea. It's good to have that imagination and explore different ideas, but you still need to have that discipline and organisation to complete the original project as well, because otherwise you never get anything published or you never get any grant success because you keep getting sidetracked. So you need to be disciplined, make sure you finish your ideas as well as explore the new ideas. I think it's important to be part of a team as well. It's very, very hard to be the lone wolf in your particular organisation who's the expert at underwater basket weaving, but nobody else is researching in that topic at all. It's very hard to be effective if you're working by yourself. So how can you sort of develop a team, part of a team? Well, obvious way is to start developing some PhD students. PhD students are a great resource. They can do the experiments you don't have time to do. They will be producing publications because they need that for their PhD, and your name is going to be on those publications, so it benefits everybody. And a lot of the work that a PhD student is doing might lead to more a bigger grant application further down the line as well. So PhD students, great resource to have. Well, it's easy to say that, but how do we actually find the funding for PhD students? And that is getting harder. The research councils used to share out funding around all the universities in the UK for PhD studentships. And they had a formula which depended on the grant income that university had captured from them. The more grant income they captured, the more brownie points they got for this PhD student fund. And you get a few PhD students every year out of that. But they stopped doing it that way. Now they put all their PhD support into doctoral training centres, which are centred at one or two universities as a specialist in that particular area. So in the computer graphics area, which was what I'm interested in, they put all their resource into a DTC that's run by University of Bath and Bournemouth University. And anything to do with digital media and graphics, if you're going to do a PhD in that area, they can't actually fill their PhD places because they've got too much funding for the people who want to go to those areas of the country to do research. Whereas other parts of the country, we might have students who want to do research in that area, but want to do it with us, and we can't get the funding to do it. So that's really frustrating, the way this DTC model works. If you're not in the club, it's making it really hard. So we rely more on self-funded students, but that's far more limited opportunities there. Usually that's an international student whose government is prepared to fund them to come to the UK to do a PhD. But it's a bit more hit and miss on whether you can find a student who's good enough and interested in your research topic. What I really like is to be recruiting students who've come through our degrees, who know us, and are enthusiastic about the projects that we're doing and find funding for them. That is a really good model, but to find the funding for doing that is getting harder and harder. You've got to start finding other grant awarding bodies to get that funding for a studentship. If you look up, just Google DTC, you know, EPS Research Council's DTC, there's a whole list of them. I'm not sure how many there are at the moment. There's about 30 plus of them all around the UK, specialising in different areas.
Okay, and they'll write out what exactly they're specialising in.
Yeah, yeah. It's all on the Research Council's websites. It's not difficult to find them.
Would there any chance that Chester could become a DTC in the same subject, or is that?
There's always a chance.
Realistically.
But realistically, the odds are against it, I think. I tried one when I was at Bangor, where it was a pan-Wales bid. We had Cardiff, Aberystwyth, Swansea and Bangor to try and do a visual computing DTC, which was our area. We had a good track record. We thought we had written a really strong bid. We didn't even get through the first round with it. And it is difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult.
I think you also have to have a minimum of EPSRC, say it's
yes.
EPSRC area,
yeah.
You have a minimum of EPSRC grant funding, so there's a sort of threshold that you have to get to before they...
That's right. Which between the four Welsh universities we did, Chester alone wouldn't be anywhere near that, so... So, well, back to build a new team. So, you know, PhDs, obvious place to start. Funding for postdocs is another way in which you grow your team. And in fact, I've actually done better at getting funding for postdocs over the last 10 years or so than PhD students. Now, it's easier to get a Research Council grant where they don't allow you to ask for PhD students anymore, but you can still ask for postdoc funding. And so ironically, I think it's easier to get, you've got a better chance of getting funding for a project which employs a postdoc than get funding for a PhD studentship. And postdocs are great. I mean, these are more mature people who've finished their PhD, so they're more independent. Potentially, they'll produce more publications, which you're involved with. And they are guys who want to become academics, so they want to get experience of writing their own grant applications. And so they could be much more productive and helpful to growing the team themselves as well. So postdocs are great. But then you need funding for PhD students, you need funding for postdocs. You can still create your team, but just collaborating with your colleagues, you know, other academics, not necessarily at your institution, but the people you know at other universities. And that's what I've done a lot of, actually. Most of my successful grant applications have been with other universities, with my colleagues who are maybe at universities that have a better overall track record of funding. So Imperial, for instance, I've got some good colleagues at Imperial, and I know that just having them on my grant application, it's going to increase my odds a little bit, because they're from Imperial. So make sure that you are networking with the people who are doing similar stuff to you at other universities. And any suggestion that comes up about doing some collaborative work, you know, jump on it and make those suggestions yourselves. It will definitely increase your chances of grant funding to have a multidisciplinary and a multi-institution proposal than just you alone. So there are definitely ways of building your team and having a more smiley face because you are working with other people. Then another part of the jigsaw, I think, is building your own esteem factors. What is it that you can do so that you're increasing your CV, making it look more impressive, and showing more experience as an effective researcher? And there's lots of things you can do to build esteem. Professional bodies can definitely help you, and you ought to be involved with a professional body. Various ones you might decide you want to get involved with. In the computing world, it might be the BCS, the British Computing Society. Well, I must admit, I'm not a member of the British Computing Society. IET, I guess most of you will know the IET, ACM. The one that I am involved in is Eurographics. That's quite specialised, I guess, for the computer graphics community. It's an international organisation, and even though it's Eurographics, it spans the whole world, not just Europe. And that's the one that I'm heavily involved with, and I'll say a little bit more about that. This is the one that I always wanted to be involved with when I was growing up, and maybe when I retire, I'll have a chance to perhaps join the Magic Circle and be part of them as well. But I guess what puts off a lot of people, particularly early career researchers, in getting involved with professional bodies, is you have to pay an annual fee to be a member of these organisations. You can't claim that feedback from your university. It's not an allowable expense that you can claim back. You have to make that investment. So Eurographics is, I think, €70 a year I pay to be a member of Eurographics. It is an allowable offset on your tax return. So you can get the money back via your tax return. So you're not totally out of pocket by joining a professional organisation, but you should do it. I definitely recommend that you find one that's most relevant to what your research area activities are and you join it, but it's not enough to just join it. If you really want to increase your esteem and maybe end up becoming a fellow of one of these institutions, you have to volunteer to do stuff. So Eurographics was the one that I got involved with, and when I first joined them, they have different chapters in different countries. I got heavily involved with the UK chapter, volunteered to run some of the UK chapter's conferences and events, became part of the UK board for Eurographics. That led me to becoming part of the board for the main Eurographics Association. I was professional board chair for a while, and then I volunteered to organise the big Eurographics conference, which rotates around Europe every year. And I brought it first to Manchester and then to Llandudno in the last 15 years or so. So that's a major thing to do, to volunteer to run and organise a big conference. But it does look good on your CV, and it gives you a whole lot of experience, a whole lot of contacts, which are going to be useful to you. So join a professional body and volunteer to do stuff. Yeah, that's a definite recommendation. Oh, here's a graph I put together. You can just about see the orange, the two lines, I think. Anybody want to guess what this is a graph of? Panos knows already, showed it to him.
Anyone who saw one say.
So
is it grant requests and exceptions?
No. But right sort of lines. The x-axis is the number of years I've been a researcher for, say, 20 years or so. And then the green line, the orange line, is the number of times since I've been an active researcher that I've received a request in my inbox to review something. So that might be a review a paper for a journal or for a conference, review a grant application, or be an external reviewer for a PhD, something like that. So I start my career, I never got anything in my inbox that invited me to be a reviewer. Then gradually they trickle in. And I immediately said yes to everything. And I think you need to. When early on in your career, if you ask to review something, never say no. Yeah, say yes. But I got to a point where the number of requests that I get grows exponentially. And it's, every week I'm getting an invite to review something these days. There's just too many. So at a certain point, when you have established yourself a bit, so after about 10 years or so, I started to say no. But for the first 10 years, I would never say no. Do it, and it's worth doing it. And then you can start to get away with turning some things down, or maybe you can pass them on to other people in your team. But doing reviewing, wherever it is, it's another important part of being an effective researcher. In fact, one way that reviewing helps you is that it's keeping you up to date with what's going on in your field. And that's a very important thing to be doing anyway. And you should be looking at the relevant journals and conference proceedings regularly, you know, seeing what people are publishing in that's related to what you are doing. And in fact, doing a review is the next way of doing that, because sometimes you even get paid for doing a review. And at the same time, you are keeping up with the latest research as well. I actually use a tool called Mendeley as a referencing tool. It's a good way of helping organising what it is that I need to be reading. And if I discover something in a journal, I can download their paper into this Mendeley tool, and it's there ready for me when I want to read it. So I find those sort of tools helpful. You may not, but they're worth looking at. But wherever, you need to have a way of keeping up to date with what's going on in your field. And that reading is the way that you're going to do that. And there are other things that you can do which are going to build your esteem. You can organise events. I've done lots of events. Eventually, you'll be asked maybe to be an associate editor on a journal. That's a good thing to do. Quite often you get invited to give guest lectures on, like, this seminar series at other universities. If you're asked to do one, go and do it. You might win prizes for your work. You get asked to be an external examiner for either degree programs or PhD theses or other things. A public engagement, too, can be really effective. Here's a guy who's been really effective in the public engagement world. And again, that's worth doing. There's lots of opportunities at Thornton for doing public engagement. So all these things are good to do. Got a new CV, and when you are evaluated for your fellowship or you're going for a big European project, they'll be looking for these sorts of things on your CV. And another easy thing to do, which a lot of people don't pay enough attention to, is your online presence. The first thing that I did on arrival in Chester was make sure I had nice-looking websites with up-to-date information. And I must give credit on this one to Panos, because Panos is the designer. He's got a real talent for designing good-looking websites. So the medical graphics group, we created our website. We've got pages off here about all the projects that we're doing. So we can go there and see projects and nice pictures. And we can see about all the people who are involved in the group. Our PhD students and everything. Our publications are there at hand. And all sorts of useful information. And we've got news down here. And keep that news up to date as well. So the last thing I put in was on the 23rd of February. People will look at your website. If you're applying for some particular role, maybe you want to be an associate editor, and you've responded to some call for applications to be that, people will look at your website. And if they see a nice-looking website, it's up-to-date, it's vibrant, that'll make a difference. And some of you as well will use social media. I'm not so hot on the social media side, But Facebook and Twitter, a lot of academics are using that really effectively, and their online presence is reinforced from all these different outlets. And it's worth doing. It's worth spending some time to do that. Okay, so funding. So I think what things I've talked about so far can all contribute in some way to how successful you are getting funding. So are you working with a team of people? What's your esteem like? How well have you been publishing? All these are factors that will help get some money. And we want to get some money to be able to do the research that we're interested in. So I'm going back to when I first joined the Manchester Visualization Centre as a raw academic, and I thought, well, yeah, what do academics do? They need to get funding. How can I get funding? European Union, they've got loads of money. Let's get some money off Europe. So that's easy to say. In fact, it turned out to be easy to do at the time as well. There are a number of reasons why I was successful in getting two Framework 5 projects at the time funded almost immediately after I joined the Manchester Visualization Centre. One project was this one, to make these web-based educational tools that had a medical theme, and we had in the web browser you could train to do medical procedures like a lumbar puncture. And another project funded at the same time was this one, and this was an environment for rehearsal and planning of a surgical procedure. We were working with mastoidectomy, so surgeons who drill into the bone. So we had a preoperative planning environment, lots of 3D rendering of medical data, using haptics to simulate drilling into the bone. So, but I'm not going to talk about the content of those projects in this talk. That's for another talk. What I want to talk about is how was it I managed to get these two European projects funded. In fact, I didn't want to get both of these projects funded because I didn't think both of them would get funded because I was the project coordinator as well for both of these projects. But I realised that I had to be. I was a raw academic. I had a limited network at the time. And I had my network from my industrial experience, but I didn't have any experience of getting European funding. But what I quickly found out was that nobody wanted to be the project coordinator for a project. And if somebody's willing to step up to the plate there, it's very relatively easy to find lots of really good groups who would be happy to join your consortium. And the reason why you don't want to be a project coordinator, but maybe it's some pain you have to go through, is that there's a lot of administration of a European project, and you're responsible for all the form filling and making sure all the partners fill in the form and dealing with all the finances. I mean, the university has infrastructure to help you do that, but it is a hassle. But I think it's pain that you should be prepared to go through. And if you've never had European funding, this is maybe something that you need to step up to do and say, I'll coordinate this. I'll take all that hassle. I want your expertise to join me in this project proposal so we can put a real good proposal together. And that worked for me with both those projects. I thought I'd be doing well to get one of them funded. So it was a bit of a mixed blessing when both of them got funded because I had to project coordinate two projects at the same time. But I can look back at it now and see that was a really good experience. It was good funding for me. It sort of set me up at Manchester. And so I don't see why anybody else can't do that as well. So putting the consortium together was another problem, and I did use my network. So as I said earlier, some of the industrial partners who I got in the consortium were people I knew from working at Silicon Graphics. And because of my interest in the medical visualization even then, I knew people at hospitals in Manchester and Leeds and elsewhere, but the two of the people I talked to was a neurosurgeon at Leeds, who I still collaborate with today, who had this idea about the web-based training tool. And he came on board as the end user. And then there was another surgeon in Manchester who was doing the mastoidectomy type surgery, and he came on board on that project. I recruited a few people from my industrial contacts, but it still needed more academics and more European partners. So I went off to a meeting in Brussels, one of these like speed dating type meetings where you just give a pitch on your project and you see if there's anybody around who's interested in it. And I was a bit dubious. This could be a complete waste of time. Went all the way to Brussels to do this. But it turned out it was a really good move. And I met some really good partners who were fantastic in these projects and helped to make them a success. So you've got to prepare to do that. You've got to do the legwork, go out and canvas and pitch for your project. And it is possible to put it all together and get a successful European project funded. Now, Horizon 2020 is a huge opportunity for us right now, and we ought to be all looking at, can we get a project together? And it might mean that you have to be the coordinator, because we're at Chester, not an Imperial, in order to make that happen.
How much science can you, I mean, if you're doing all this project management, which is very, you know, all these emails coming in and budgets, I mean, can you also do, how much science can you do alongside all that project?
Me personally, as the project coordinator, was more limited, but it gave me the funding to have the postdoc who would do that science, which I'd be involved with. So the experiments would probably be done by your postdocs, and you have to get that trade-off. There was a lot of form filling and organisation to be done, which I had to do. So yeah, you got to trade it off, but you still get your names on the paper and get involved in the nice bits of the research, and you can leave the more laborious research bits to the to the postdoc that you funded. Research councils, obviously, is another big source of funding. It's getting harder and harder, but all you can do is keep trying, and do keep trying. The biggest EPSRC grant that I got, we got it on the third attempt, I think it was, after a lot of canvassing, and it was a multi-site project, again, to do with virtual reality surgery. And it was completely panned the first time we put it in. So we addressed the comments, we put it in stronger, we did a lot of canvassing with the EPSCC themselves. And in the end, we had a special panel meeting where they invited independent academics just to look at our project and decide if it should be funded, which was quite exceptional at the time, because normally your project is in with 40 or 50 other proposals, and the panel have to rank these 40 or 50 proposals, and the top six will get funded. So, by persevering, trying and trying again, we actually got some money in the end. For those of you who are early career researchers, there's slightly easier, well, not much, but they do have something called the First Grant Scheme, which are for people who have been, or in their first academic post, really. And there is a time limit on which you can, within which you have to apply, but you're only ranked against other early career researchers, so you're competing against far less people. So your odds are better, but it is still tough to get these grants. I think another thing that's helped me with the EPSRC is that I got myself onto the EPSRC College. Now, the EPSRC College is about 4,000 people, mostly in the UK, but internationally as well, who are the main pool of people that the EPSRC call on to review grant proposals. And also, the panels that will rank the proposals are drawn from the EPSRC College. I was looking to see who at Chester was a member of the EPSRC College, and I am, Nick is, and I think Julie Ford in maths. So not too many people from Chester who are currently members of the EPSRC College. To get on, they do periodically issue calls for members to join the college, and you can apply. When I did it, you had to have two other independent academics who would recommend you and second that recommendation. But I realised that it was never going to happen if I was relying on people who just nominated me. I had to make sure that somebody was going to nominate me. So as soon as I saw the call, I was ringing up my friend at a different university and said, please nominate me. And I rang up another friend at another university and said, so-and-so's going to nominate me, will you second me? And I made sure that happened. And you can get on the college. Once you're on the college, there's all sorts of training available to you, mock panels, and you can maybe go on real panels. That is a really valuable experience. I've been on quite a few panels now, gets a lot of work, so they suddenly have 40 research proposals arriving on your doorstep, which you were supposed to look at in at least cursory for some of them, but there'll be about half a dozen where you have to look at in more detail, and you'll be the first speaker or the second speaker at the panel giving your opinion on the quality of these proposals. And it's your opinions that end up really influencing the ranking and who's going to get funded or not. So you have incredible influence when you're on these panels. You're supposed to act completely independently, but I'm not convinced everybody on the panels do. There's infighting between different disciplines, and people support a grant in their area of interest and try and fight for that one rather than another proposal. So it's a really interesting experience, and I always come away feeling a little bit unsatisfied with the way it all went, actually. But being part of it is invaluable, that's for sure. And I've been able to use that experience in some of my bits. You can also get funding from the government. At Bangor, I got a lot of funding from the Welsh government, regional development schemes, and other things in Cheshire that we can apply for as well. Those are good sources of funding. NHS, my research area, I've had funding from them. I'm currently looking at the Government Defence Organisation, CDE, that they have pots of money available as well, which if you can have some sort of security or defence application to your research, then you can go to them, and there'll be less competition there. So always look around for where your options are. Charities as well are another good source of potential funding. Perhaps best known one is the Leverhulme Trust. They fund millions every year on blue sky research or applied research type projects, covering a whole gamut of application areas. Royal Society as well, that can give you small pots of money for equipment and innovation type schemes. You know, in the medical world, Malcolm Trust is another big one. But there are lots of little charities as well. I've got two examples there, the logos. One is the Sister Jules Thorne Charitable Trust. So that Jules Thorne is the Thorne from Thorne EMI, and he left a big legacy to fund research of medical related projects. And in fact, this was the very first grant success I had after becoming an academic. Before my two European projects at Manchester, I was sitting on my computer thinking, funding, how can I get funding? And I did an extensive search for everybody who would fund a project vaguely in the area I was interested in, medical visualization. So came across the Sir Jules Thorne website by just doing a search. Don't think it was Google search, because I don't think Google was around then, but it might have been Alta Vista. But I found them, and I looked at what they did. They didn't really do what I wanted to do, which was medical visualization, but they had lots of the right things in what they wanted to fund, so I thought, let's give them a try. And in fact, they liked my proposal, and they'd never funded any sort of computer science group before, but they liked the idea of this medical visualization tool, which I sold them, and that was my first ever project I got funded from perhaps an unexpected source. And here's another charity that I'm sure nobody's heard of. It's the Ron and Margaret Smith Cancer Appeal. This is a very specific charity for Glanclwyd Hospital in North Wales, particularly associated with the cancer unit at that hospital. And they just raise money to help support that cancer unit at that one hospital. But this is the charity that's funding one of my part-time PhD students right now. So some of you have met Francesco, who he actually works at that hospital, but part-time he's doing a PhD with me. And it's this charity that's paying for his fees to the university to do that. So you never know where you can get the funding from. So you need to be creative and look around for opportunities. Don't just stick with the obvious sources of funding. There will be other smaller, maybe, but still valuable grant funders that you can approach.
What I've gotten so far is that the most important criteria is for you to be a European.
Is what, sorry?
It's for you to be a European. Like, you can.
That's the most important criteria. I am pro Europe. I'll be voting to stay in Europe because I think the European funding is a great way of getting the research done, even though there's all that administration overhead. But once you start collaborating with some of the European colleagues and their universities and institutes, you gain a lot from that. But that's just one source. The research councils will be UK specific funding, and that wouldn't involve anything else from Europe. These charities will probably be mainly UK only projects as well.
Okay. What I meant is, I have to be a European, I have to be a citizen to be able to get funding.
Okay, so you're an international citizenship.
Yeah. Would I be able to? Because most of the things you mentioned are mostly for people that are citizens or.
No, I think the only one that's really specific about UK citizenship was the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. If you're in post at a UK university, then you would qualify to apply for these grants. So the actual grant holder for a European project would be Chester University. It wouldn't be you.
Okay.
And Chester University qualifies. So if you're in post, permanent post probably, I think rather than a temporary post. Yeah, it's a bit more complicated if you're only in temporary post. But if you're an academic at the university, you can apply to Europe, you can apply to the research councils.
Actually, Nigel, the European Union have like schemes such as TIMBUS, Erasmus, and FP7,
yes,
where they can apply. Like some projects can like be national and international
universities, right, yeah,
where they like together make a small project. Or
yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's.
And the purpose actually for those such projects is to exchange experience,
yeah,
between like developing countries and developing,
yeah,
countries.
So there's lots of schemes. You know, once you start digging, you'll see more and more opportunities that you can go for. Industry as well. You can yet another source of funding. You could get commissions from companies. There are schemes like Innovit UK where you need an industrial partner, KTP or knowledge transfer projects. These all provide opportunities, but you do need to have an industrial partner who's willing to put some investment into that project, maybe cash, but maybe funding in kind. But again, other opportunities you can explore. Maybe you can set up your own company as well, and sell your invention yourself and give the university a small cut. And Thornton's got plenty of space for your startup company, so something else you can think of doing as well. So time to finish. I've gone on much longer than I thought, actually. But my last slide, almost my last slide, is I think it's also important to have a good place where you can think about your research and what you want to do, which is away from the office. For me, it's on my bike. But for you, it might be I'll go for a long walk. I might be sitting on the beach in the deck chair. You need somewhere where you can just think, in a nice place where you feel comfortable and away from distractions. And it's me. All my best ideas come when I'm riding my bike somewhere, I think. So it's you need to do that as well. Yeah, so I'll stop now. We've had a good discussion, I think, as we've gone through. I'm quite happy to carry on talking with you about this. If you've got things, ideas that I haven't covered, then now's the time to bring them up. And I don't know if you can read the text, but what Bart is writing there is that 100 times I will not give up on my grant application. So I'll end it there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nigel. Well, before questions, let me just add that this presentation will be available online. The link I emailed you, there will be a place I will embed it so that you can access it and also talk to Nigel later.
Yeah.
Okay, I was wondering if you can talk about the first grant application, because I know I've had that conversation,
yeah,
with you, and it looks like you're qualified to apply within the first 10 years of finishing your PhD.
Yeah, I think it's 10 years. Do you know, Panos, because you're looking at the dates?
It's 10 years. You can get an extension on some circumstances. For example, I got an extension from a national military service, which was a year. They told, okay, you're not doing any work, we can give you an extension. I sort of tried to give an extension for my break in the industry, but I couldn't prove that it was completely irrelevant to my research activities. So there are opportunities,
yeah,
to extend that.
For 10 years, is it? Yeah.
The maximum that you can extend the whole thing to is 3 years after you have your first post as a lecturer. You cannot go beyond that anyway.
10 years is a long time as well, because if you're going to use the first grant scheme, it has to be your first grant application as the principal investigator. And for me, 10 years, you should be having at least 3 applications into the EPSLC in that sort of time period. but only the first one can go to the first grant scheme. So don't wait 10 years. You need to have a good proposal, but get in as soon as you can, as long as it's good. Yeah. So you have to be in the position to apply, which is what.
So, are there any actual funding schemes targeted for people who are in temporary positions, or at least contract positions?
I think if you, as long as you are post spans the period that the project is going to be funded for, then a lot of funding bodies would be happy with that. I think a lot of the charities I've had funding from, that's their criteria, that if I've asked for funding for 3 years, then the principal investigator, as long as they're in post for that whole period, then that will be fine. It'll vary slightly with different funding bodies, but I think the research councils do want you to have that permanent post, but other sources, as long as you can show that you will be in post for that duration of the project, you'll be okay.
I can say about it because it was my case, but if you are not permanent position in the university, you cannot UPI in most of the councils. You can be a name assessor with the federal amount.
Yeah, CI, you can go
investigator, but PI, most of them, they don't like it because of the case that you can lose your job anyway.
Okay, another question over here.
Yeah, just to sort of stress that as well, I felt I was on a URF before I came here, so 10 years, but 5 plus 3 plus 2.
Right.
And the first 5 years was fine, doing the PSRC grant and things in, but then after that, it got harder and harder because you fall foul of the position for the duration of the grant.
Right.
And I did have a referee very kindly on one of my grants projections point out the fact that I was in URF and therefore probably didn't have a position for the duration of the grant, and it got thrown out on those grounds. So, yeah, you do have to be careful as to which scheme you have and what position you're in.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not easy.
Can I just raise one more difficulty, which is that EPSRC are implementing what they call a demand management scheme, which means that if you put in a rubbish application, you get blackballed, says that you can't, if you do it, I think it's 3 times, or twice within so many years, then you're not allowed to apply. You have to have a year's remission and go off and do some training before you can resubmit or put your proposal in. And
This was to stop people just resubmitting proposals time and time again, and all the work that they have to do to get them reviewed, they want, was too much. So this is their way of stopping you just doing that. And
so it's really important that if you're new to EPSRC, don't squirrel away on your application and then just at the last minute expect somebody to the university to submit it for you. You need to get it sort of peer reviewed within the institution as well, before it goes out to the EPSRC. So when you think about the deadline, if there's a deadline, sometimes there's not, it's responsive mode, but if there's a deadline, try and build in a period where you can get your colleagues to offer you some peer review before you submit.
I found the research office at Chester to be quite good, actually, in supporting you in your grant application, and because you need them to work out the finances of the salary cost and everything. And they've been really good, and have a good team to help you to do that. So make use of them.
Would you say that in my experience, you're very much in the hands of the PhD students to a certain extent? Because I started off when I was inexperienced with, frankly, a quite weak student, so I gave them the benefit of the doubt. And eventually we had all these panels and that they had to leave, they just weren't up to it.
Right.
And you had another experience of like a real superstar student, and it was like a walk in the park, and then a medium student. So is that a fair comment? You really are
Well, you shouldn't have all your irons in the PhD student's fire, but yeah, I mean, if you've got a good PhD student who's going to get really good publications, that's great, you know, and you're going to get more mediocre ones as well. But that should just part of your sort of research portfolio and your research strategy. So
be diversified.
Yeah.
A PhD student might continue his work after 3 years and stay postdoc for another two, and then you can get a very expensive project.
Yeah.
Postdoc, usually you hire if you want the problem to be solved in a specific time with specific money.
Yeah.
They've got leverage in 5 years, haven't they? They've got 2 or 3 years for a PhD, and they're really knowledgeable, and then you can carry on another 2 years, you can get
well, yeah.
You can be really...
Yeah, I've been lucky enough that a few of my PhD students have managed to find funding for them because we used their work to get funded projects, and they were around for another couple of years after that. So, and I think nearly all of those are now lecturers in their own right now. So it's if you get that pipeline going, it could be very productive.
So coming back on the first grant scheme, if there's an application to another research council as PI, would that affect the first grant to EPSRC?
Yeah, you can only do a first grant scheme to one of the research councils. So you can't hedge your bets and put it into two different research councils. It would have to be quite different anyway if you go into the BBSRC and the EPSRC. That would have to be quite different.
If it was, say, a grant to Innovate UK, would
that... Oh, Innovate UK, you'd be all right. You're quite happy. Outside of the research councils, you can still be applying for grants, industrial ones or even European one, and that wouldn't disqualify you from doing the first grant to the EPSRC or any of the other research councils.
What I heard is in the UK and EPSRC and everything, they're going to merge to RC UK. Do you know if that will affect it?
So I don't know enough about what the plans are there to answer that, really. But yeah, that could affect things if they are more merged and coming out of the same funding pot, then that might not be so easy to do the multiple grant applications, but I don't know enough about what's going on there.
I have little experience with this, campus projects and Erasmus projects, and I think it's very difficult to be coordinator, as you said, because there's a lot of administration requirements you have to do. But as a good start, it's good to register yourself there is websites for those projects, and you get emails like for small Corinthians, small group of universities, and they're looking for partners.
Yeah.
And you get, and they'll ask if you're interested. So you can, as a start, you can join those Corinthians, and then you can...
Yeah, that's good. I've done that as well. Yeah. So
there are also a couple of LinkedIn groups that do the same. They have quite a lot of members,
right,
and provost members, and a lot of people ask for a partnership to say, this is what we're involved with, we're looking for a partner in, I don't know when, so then you can actually establish sort of like communication through that. Okay. Don't know exactly what you're getting into, but you can always find that.
Okay, anything else? Yeah, one more.
I was wondering actually, if, say you're eligible for a first grant scheme with EPSRC, but you already applied to another community, is this a
No, you can do that. You can apply to Leverhulme and then still go for the first grant scheme.
Okay.
It's first grant to the research councils. Grants elsewhere, they won't know about that. So.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, guys, the tea and the coffee here for us.
Okay, pleasure.
Which software are you
using? So I've never used this software before. It's called Emaze. It's a purely web-based presentation tool. So you do it all online in a web browser.
E-O-E-M-O-E.
E-N-A-Z-E.
E-M-A-Z-E.
Yeah.